Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, Sebastian Budgen analyzes the French election, and Sofia Japaridze reports on how NGOs have turned the country of Georgia into an impoverished libertarian laboratory. First, France. On April 23rd, France held an election to choose a successor to the disastrous President Hollande. Hollande, a nominal socialist, managed to alienate nearly everyone, earning some of the lowest approval ratings of any politician in the world. The initial field consisted of 11 candidates. Under French law, if no one gains a majority in the first round, there's a second runoff election between the top two candidates held 2 weeks after the first. Neither candidate of the two previously dominant parties, the socialists on the center-left and the Republicans on the center-right, qualified. The winners were Emmanuel Macron, an investment banker with little political experience, and Marine Le Pen of the partly renovated far-right party, the National Front. The National Front was co-founded by Marine Le Pen's father, Jean-Marie, as an explicitly neo-fascist operation nostalgic for the days of Nazi-occupied France. He was expelled from the party in 2015 by his daughter, who'd taken it over and tried to sanitize its image. The big surprise of the first round was the strong performance of the serious leftist, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who came in less than 2 points behind Le Pen. Here's Sebastian Budgen, a senior editor at Verso and a member of the editorial board of Historical Materialism, with more. It looks like France is going to experience a similar blackmail of one we've heard. It's getting rather familiar now. Vote for the neoliberal to stop the neo-fascist. Is it going to work?
I think it's very likely to work, yes, for several reasons. First of all, obviously, because Marine Le Pen, for all the demonization of the Front National, clearly still represents a far-right political force. They've, of course, changed their discourse on a number of issues, but it's clear that it's still a racist and authoritarian party. Secondly, because Macron, the Hillary bot, if you like, isn't quite as politically bankrupt as Hillary Clinton, in the sense that he's young and fresh and new and no stains on him yet. And thirdly, because the entire political establishment, right and left, are calling for a vote for him. Now, obviously, that doesn't guarantee that will translate into the popular vote, but at the moment, at least, the lead in the polls is so substantial, it would be difficult to imagine, unless there's a massive abstention, that he could lose.
And Macron's politics, he's a former investment banker. He served briefly as, an economy minister. What are his politics? The standard issue of the illiberal, or what?
Slightly unusual for the French situation. He's kind of a Tony Blair figure, if you like. He is slightly unusual for the French context because he's on a explicitly neoliberal line with a smile. You know, it's neoliberalism, but of course we'll compensate you with various types of flexi-security and so on. So it's not the neoliberalism with a snarl that the Thatcherite program that was being promised by François Fillon. But he's unusual in the French context because he allies that with a political liberalism, if you like, on issues to do with Islam and secularism and gay rights and so on. So he's more of an American neoliberal, if you like, in the sense that he combines both economic liberalism and political liberalism.
Could you say a bit more about his stance on Islam and secularism?
Yeah, I mean, he's not particularly distinctive. He doesn't have a particularly strong analysis, but he hasn't hitherto, at least, unlike the vast majority of the establishment candidates, used an Islamophobic dog whistle type rhetoric. He hasn't said anything particularly outrageous about the headscarf and so on. He's for a more relaxed attitude to those kinds of issues, and he's more on a line of equal opportunities. The young kids from the banlieue should be given their chance to create their own businesses and so on and so forth. It's a neoliberal anti-racist or non-racist position.
Sounds like someone who would fit in with the our Democratic Party.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think he is. It's very much a product of the Americanization of French politics. You know, there are some who fantasize, believe it or not, about creating a Democratic Party in France out of all the wreckage of these elections. So, no doubt the process will go further.
Why would someone want to do such a thing? And Le Pen, she has somewhat tried to sanitize the image of the party that her father dominated for so long. Just what are her politics on the surface and then under the surface?
Well, on the surface, she has quite a coherent message. She says she has now posed as the defender of the French welfare state, of the French dirigiste state, of French political geopolitical independence. So she says she's against what she calls globalism. She's against what she calls ultra-liberalism. She says she's for a form of protectionism, economic protectionism. She says that she's not a racist. She's just in favor of people integrating into the host community, and that she is supposedly, defending secularism and women's rights.
Okay, so what about under the surface? What lurks underneath her somewhat sanitized exterior?
I don't think the fundamental politics of the Front National have changed. What she has tried to do is put distance between herself and the nostalgics of the Vichy regime, the nostalgics of the Third Reich. She still has very close friends who are neo-fascists, and there are neo-fascists in and around the ranks of the Front National. I think what's fundamentally different is that she wanted to and has been successful in enlarging the Front National electorate towards a working class vote rather than just relying on the traditional petit bourgeois votes, particularly in the south of France. And she's changed her political strategy. So rather than the strategy of her father, which was to hold fast to a position in expectation of the explosion of the traditional right on a very extremely right-wing position, she wants to outflank the right by, as I say, winning away their popular voters and potentially creating a situation in which a section of the traditional right might consider breaking away or creating some kind of coalition or deal with her.
Her vote was quite strong in the north, correct?
Yeah, she has two now. Traditionally, the Front National was strong in the south of France, and she has now, with her new strategy, managed to implant the Front National in the north of France, which is traditionally a working class, deindustrialized region.
Now, this is becoming a familiar pattern. Deindustrialized regions who are full of despair and unemployment turn to right-wing saviors. Is this a former left base that has turned to the right?
Exactly, yes. The north of France was one of the electoral bases of the Socialist Party and the Communist Party. The Socialist Party has basically run it on a clientelistic basis for many decades now, with a lot of corruption and obviously not much material benefits for its electorate. And a section of that electorate is obviously looking for a way out, both towards Marine Le Pen and Jean-Luc Mélenchon.
What was her father's line of the welfare state? Has she changed that?
Yes. I mean, Jean-Marie Le Pen was a Reaganite in the 80s. He was actually pro-EU as well. He had a kind of, petit bourgeois critique of the state being bloated, artisans and independent workers suffering under taxes, and it was a socialist state and it needed to be cut down and so on and so forth. Marine Le Pen and her advisors have shifted to a line of welfare state chauvinism, so defending the welfare state but only for French, quote-unquote, workers, and defending Social Security and, an ambiguous line on some questions to do with working conditions and so on.
Immigrants, if they learn good French and don't wear headscarves, are they considered French by her, or is it a matter of blood?
Well, it's obviously moot, isn't it? I mean, one of the things she wants to do is to replace the droit du sol, which is the idea that you can have citizenship regardless of your ascendancy, with the droit du sang, the bloodline. So there's obviously clearly an ethnic factor in there, but it's overlain with a discourse about secularism and integration. I think it's clear that there's still a racist, ethnocentric conception, but it's increasingly well camouflaged behind a facade about this is not about white or non-white, this is about French law-respecting people and Islamists and what they call communitarians and so on.
What are her relations with Mark Blight calls the Trumpist International?
She welcomed the Trump election, she did Brexit, but I mean, her relations, as far as I can work out, with the American far right are pretty weak. I mean, I think to the extent that they exist via her more kind of far out connections. She doesn't have anything organic, as far as I can. both because of the excesses that that they can embarrass her by, but also because, you know, she has a line about French geopolitical independence, and that obviously doesn't look too good if you're cozying up to the U.S.
And what about the master puppet manipulator in Moscow, Vladimir Putin?
Well, yeah, I mean, she has a pro-Putin line clearly on Syria and Ukraine and so on. And she got famously a bank loan last time round from a Russian bank or a bank that was reliant on Russia. But again, it's not clear how much these are just purely sort of instrumental, opportunistic relations and how organic they are at this point. There are clearly people within the Front National who are very pro-Alexander Dugin and the whole Eurasianist notion of some ideologues around Putin. And, you know, they have fantasies about a kind of red-brown alliance supported by Putin, but I'm not sure how real that is and how much that is a fantasy, as I say, at this stage.
Now, aside from the two finalists here, there were, what, nine other candidates. What about those? For example, the socialist nominee who did very, very poorly.
The big news, yes, of course, of the elections is the elimination of the two main pillars, establishment pillars of French politics, the right, the centre-right, who didn't get through to the second round and got a poor vote, although it must be said, in the circumstances, a better vote than I was expecting, given the corruption scandals around the candidate, and most dramatically, the Socialist Party, which got its worst vote since 1969, just over 6%. And, of course, 1969, the disaster of 1969, when they got 5%, led to the whole cycle that led to Mitterrand refounding the Socialist Party in 1971. So we're clearly at the end of the road for the Socialist Party. It's perhaps one of the best bits of news of that election.
And then Fillon, was he undone by scandal or was it his politics as well?
Well, he stood on a very right-wing, Thatcherite, openly neoliberal platform, which infused his ranks but didn't have a very big electoral appeal more generally. He started losing support already when it looked like he was pushing a kind of program of partial privatization of Social Security. But yeah, what really did for him were the corruption scandals about the employment of his wife and his kids, and then various other scandals about him being offered very expensive suits by businessmen and so on. And given that he'd stood on a platform of being the respectable bourgeois candidate as against the slightly creepy nouveau riche bling Sarkozy type figure, that obviously destroyed that specificity for him, and I think it made some people on the right pretty uncomfortable. Yeah.
I'm speaking with Sebastian Budgen, a senior editor at Verso and a member of the Historical Materialism editorial board.
And then the great hope of the left, Mélenchon. What was your opinion of him, and what, if anything, does he portend for the future?
Well, it has to be said that his campaign and his result is quite historic. I mean, it's the best result, just over 19%. It's the best result for a candidate to the left of the Socialist Party since 1981. And it's almost up to the level of the last historic high, which was the Communist Party candidate in 1969, who Jacques Duclos, who got 21%. So it's a massively important result, I think. All the more so in circumstances where, from the very beginning of the electoral cycle, everybody was saying that the left was completely written off. This was simply going to be a two-horse race between the right and the far right, given also that obviously it was in the context of a Socialist Party government that had disappointed vast ranks and demobilized vast ranks of the left with the protests last spring against its labor code reforms, for example, and also in circumstances where Mélenchon really launched a campaign without a party, having left behind his Communist Party allies that he'd run with in 2012 and really created this kind of odd structure that managed to carry him up to this level for the presidential election. So it has to be, you know, and it was a vibrant, energetic, impressive campaign with some enormous rallies, demonstrations, and innovative use also of social media and the internet and so on. So, I think whatever criticisms one might have of his politics, and I think there are some serious criticisms one could make, it's a real achievement, and it's he came within a whisker of being qualified for the second round, which no one would have put any money on at the beginning of this cycle, and you just have to look at the Socialist Party vote plus the Mélenchon vote. You know, it's 26%. He would have been the front running candidate had there not been this rather annoying competition from the irrelevant Socialist Party. So it's a real overturning of the situation previously, and what it portends us to the future is a big question, Doug.
That's the puppet you gave for you. You're supposed to. Before we talk about the future, what were his politics, or what are his politics, and what critique might you have of them?
Well, Milosz was somebody who started off on the far left. He was a Trotskyist in the 60s and early 70s. He joined the Socialist Party in the late 70s. He was consistently on the left of the party. He became one of the youngest senators for the Socialist Party and was on the left of the party throughout the 80s and 90s, but being on the left of the Socialist Party means really, you know, being involved in lots of internal maneuvering and so on. It doesn't mean necessarily having an organic relationship with social movements or that kind of thing. It's a very incestuous kind of airtight world. But he was on the left of the party. He has a fascination and hero worship of François Mitterrand, which is, you know, kind of concerning in and of itself, given the character of that particular politician. He saw really that he wasn't getting anywhere within the Socialist Party, and I think the big break for him was in 2005 with the massive campaign against the European Constitutional Treaty, where all sort of sections of the left came together and defeated the establishment on that vote. And I think he saw that, you know, there was perhaps a space and an opportunity for him outside of the Socialist Party, and he broke a few years later and created his own small party and then the Left Front, which was an alliance with the Communist Party and other forces. So in terms of the basic structure of his politics, he describes himself as a Republican Socialist, which means that he can have quite good politics on social issues. It's left social democracy, but it's quite combative left social democracy, Keynesianism, but it's twisted with new elements such as ecology. He's in favor, for example, of ecological planning, which is a clever way of bringing together the left theme of planning and the theme of ecology. So on those kinds of issues, he's quite combative, as I say, and effective. Where he's weak is his identification with the French state, an idealization of the French Republican form, which he wants to change. He's campaigned also for a sixth republic, a more democratic, less presidentialist republic. But he really sees the French republic as an emanation of the French Revolution, which, you know, in a sense it is, but quite a lot happened between the French Revolution and today, including some counter-revolutions and some killings of thousands of communards, for example. And that leads him to have two main, I think, weaknesses. One, internally, on the question of race and Islam, where he really doesn't get it at all. He thinks that state secularism is simply a question of treating all religions equally, at an equal distance from the state. Doesn't understand the racialization of people from Muslim backgrounds in France, and is very hostile to any kinds of politics that recognizes that as a central issue for the left. And on external issues, he's adopted what he calls a Gaullist position of, you know, fighting for French independence, withdrawal from NATO, not being subaltern to the US, all of which are good things, and for a kind of what he calls a multipolar geopolitics. But I would say that there are problems with the way he positions himself on some international questions. Sometimes he's unfairly treated by the media and boxed into a corner on questions like Syria and Russia, but sometimes he doesn't make life very easy for himself in some of his formulations. But he certainly identifies himself with the French state and, you know, with the vast majority of its military escapades abroad, and is very uncomfortable about fully accepting and engaging in a proper self-criticism about France's colonial past and indeed present, because, as you know, France is still a colonial power. Many of the people who voted in Sunday's election are in places like Guyana, Martinique, Guadeloupe, and so on, which are still existent French colonies.
We haven't really talked about Hollande, but why was he such a failure?
Well, I mean, he's a very pathetic character as a person and as a politician. He's a maneuverer, has always been a maneuverer, has never really stood for any particular set of strong values apart from being always on the right of the party and wanting. He's one of the people that, you know, has fantasized for many years about turning the Socialist Party into a democratic party. He's never been somebody who's particularly attracted by ideology. He's an internal party maneuverer. And, you know, he ran in 2012 on a very moderate program, but he did say certain things. He laid down certain markers about being, you know, the enemy of finance, of high finance, of wanting, you know, to introduce fiscal justice vis-a-vis the super rich. And very quickly collapsed on those issues, collapsed on the European issue, and in fact, you know, did a 180-degree turn and passed a whole series of laws which were handouts to the employer class, of which the worst example was this labor code reforms, which provoked these big strikes and demonstrations last spring. And then when the terrorist attacks happened, he, desperately seeking some source of support, positioned himself as the strong leader, engaged in these military escapades in Mali, Syria, and elsewhere, and attempted a disastrous law reform, which didn't go through in the end, about stripping dual nationals of French nationality if they were involved in terrorist acts, which was extremely unpopular on the left, even within his own camp, and, you know, passing a whole series of very stringent security laws and a law of emergency, which is still in effect today. He really cut himself off from basically every possible source of left support that he could get, whether it was public sector, whether it was the trade unions, whether it was the so-called moral left, every possible sector that he managed to create a coalition around in 2012, he managed to lop off and was left with nothing by the end.
And under the French system, the presidency is a very powerful office, right?
It is. It's much more powerful, arguably, than the American presidency, for example. There are a whole series of constitutional mechanisms which basically mean that President Le Pen, for example, could bypass the National Assembly, and especially now with these anti-terrorist laws and the state of emergency, could have very substantial authoritarian powers.
So what are we to expect for the runoff? It's, what, in a couple of weeks?
It's June 7th. Well, you know, there will be a campaign in which the entire, as I say, media, political and economic establishment will rally around Macron. The markets have already welcomed his, of course, his front-running status as the best possible news. Marine Le Pen will try and broaden her base by trying to appeal to people on the right who can't quite stomach voting for somebody who was in a Socialist Party government, however neoliberal he is. Various Catholic traditionalists who, for example, can't forgive the idea of the gay marriage law that Hollande passed, just about the only bit of legislation worth defending. And also she will try and woo some disaffected working class voters who perhaps voted for Mélenchon by, you know, pointing out quite rightly that the reforms that Macron is promising to bring in will shred the French social model. How that will play out, I don't know yet. A lot depends on how effective the Front National is at widening this base.
And Mélenchon has withheld an endorsement so far, right?
Yes. He said he's going to consult by internet his tens of thousands of supporters, but he has clearly said that he doesn't feel that it's his role to give support to Macron against Le Pen at this stage anyway.
And what would you do?
Well, it's going to be an uncomfortable couple of weeks, isn't it? I mean, a lot depends on the polls, I suppose. We're all going to be looking at the polls and not believing them as we read our horoscopes and don't believe them. I think there will be lots of people who will abstain if the polls, you know, look like it's going to be an easy coast to victory for Macron anyway. I suspect that there will be people who will swallow their pride and vote for him ultimately if it looks like it's going to be a close race.
He's almost certainly going to prove unpopular if he wins. Does Mélenchon have a future, or is it the future belong to Le Pen?
No, I think the big good news of this election is that, you know, what was supposed to be a two-horse race turned into a three-horse race, and what was supposed to be a three-horse race turned into a four-horse race, and the fourth horse was this radical left candidacy, which, as I say, achieved a very impressive result in very difficult circumstances. So there clearly is a space now to create something substantial. We've got rid of, I hope, of the Socialist Party, which was the big barrier to any recomposition on the left. We'll see in the legislative elections in June, 7th of May, I got the date wrong on the second round, the 7th of May for presidential elections and June elections for the legislative. So we'll see if the Socialist Party manages to reconstruct itself. But at the moment, at least, it looks like it's been cleared away, and there is definitely a space. Now, what is done with that space, and whether Mélenchon is capable of exploiting it in a constructive way, whether he will continue himself. I mean, he's intimated he may stand down or not be the leading figure anymore. We will see. What is done with all that is obviously up in the air, and you know the left is more than capable, as we know, Doug, of screwing up every chance it's ever had to create a united, recomposed alternative. So we certainly can't say it's guaranteed, but there's definitely a serious possibility now.
That was Sebastian Budgen, a senior editor at Verso and a member of the editorial board of Historical Materialism. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was the 29th of the Goldberg Variations by Bach, performed by Glenn Gould. Next, Georgia, a former Soviet republic that has been turned into a libertarian dream state by a bunch of foreign NGOs. Capital has absolute free rein, and the flat tax is almost unalterably enshrined in the Constitution. Here's Sofia Japaridze, a labor and feminist organizer, whose group is called Invisible Labor, with more. Most Americans don't think about Georgia, the country, very much. But it's had quite a post-Soviet history. Could you give us the quick outline of what's been happening since the USSR fell apart?
We had our own national movement here, which was not as strong as in Poland and other countries. It was also anti-capitalist. It was more like feudal, nationalist or feudal, some callback for some kind of a mythical Georgia that exists like only in books. This had to do with the fact that generally it was culture that was most accented as a way to keep Russian chauvinism at bay. USSR itself, like Moscow, promoted Georgian cultural sort of identity. So the liberation movement took on that kind of cultural sort of nationalism.
If I could detour a bit, what's the status, or what was the status then and now, of the most famous Georgian of all, Stalin?
In Gori, where he was born, there's still a cult there. I mean, really... They had a supermarket with Stalin's face on it. I mean, they really, really love Stalin. And there's a actual really big sort of communist, Stalinist sort of presence there. They're really reactionary on a lot of politics. They're better on the economic side, but everything else is kind of reactionary. But they're really yearning back for, USSR and that kind of we used to be great.
Make Georgia great again.
Yeah, there's a make Georgia great again. And they're like, only with Russia can we do this. Because we cannot be so strong because we're so small, right? So you have to sort of ally yourself with a larger country to be great again. And mostly, generally, I get the sense that people hate Lenin way more than Stalin. Like, they still have a soft spot for Stalin, because he's Georgian. And they're like, Lenin, no, he was horrible. But Stalin, we could see what he was thinking,
Okay, so back to the post-Soviet history.
Yeah, anyway, so it's a cultural sort of nationalism, and then, USSR just kind of stopped, and there was a huge just economic crisis, because most of our bread and a lot of things were actually coming from Russia, and we really weren't making that much here. And so there's a huge economic catastrophe. The leader, Gamsakhurdia, who was the head of the national movement, he was sort of a terrible statesman, plus he also had sort of anti-capitalist, kind of more feudal mentality. He really didn't know at all what to do with the economy, and it was such a crisis. And at the same time, civil wars, because there was a lot of cleansing of ethnic minorities, the Georgia for Georgians. All this led to people toppling him. Very few people, actually. It was 2,000 people toppled him. Anyway, they got rid of him, and they called back Shevardnadze, who was old USSR president, or whatever it's called now.
The diplomat.
You know, so Shevardnadze was called back, like really kind of almost begged, like, please come back and save us, or at least stabilize us. And he came back, and he did stabilize Georgia for a long time, until 2003. It's just that he wasn't able to do much more than that. I mean, there's also rampant, you know, corruption. I mean, corruption, I don't look at it as that bad, because it was like more horizontal corruption, you know, sort of everyone was involved, and that's how everything was sort of working. It had its own logic. But he wasn't able to really reform to that level, and because there was all these networks that he had created to keep stability, that he couldn't actually discipline afterward. And because of also a lot of petty crimes, you know, and there's constant shortages of power. And that's like the 90s, what most people remember is like no lights, lots of petty crime, but a lot more solidarity because people were forced to then sort of help each other out. Then there was elections, which he outright stole. And it was like very apparent. Right before that, he was very free with like NGOs. And so a lot of NGOs came here, a lot of American funders, donors. There was a Liberty Institute. There was like all these different kinds of NGOs, which really didn't have popular support, but they were funded mostly by foreign governments. Usually the forms, the ideas that they were working on had a lot to do with freedom being defined as free markets. This ideology, this free market ideology, is freedom, is only looked upon as open borders, you know, like no constraints on business. And these were the people, State Department, Freedom House, that supported student movement here, student movement that took on the Liberty Institute. If you can tell, Liberty Institute is already like free market ideology. It was already working for a while, like a think tank. These two student movements that emerged defend the right-wing TV station called Rustavi Ordi, which was constantly criticizing Shevardnadze, and Shevardnadze was actually not very repressive, but he did try to shut it down once, and this like enraged people, the right-wingers, who like started a student movement, who framed it in a freedom, like freedom of media. Interesting enough, during Shevardnadze, the media was much more free than after. There was the on-the-ground movement, which was the students, which weren't that big, but it was enough, which mobilized people. And then there was Saakashvili, who left Shevardnadze at the time. Saakashvili then became the Rose Revolution. Maybe you have heard of that. No one knows anything about Georgia. And so in parliament, you have Saakashvili, who's a leader of this party. And you have other sort of dissidents, who are just kind of tired of Shevardnadze. Like, they want reforms. Then you have the TV station, Rustavi Ordi. So these three things culminated, and this, especially when the elections happened, and it was like fraudulent. And U.S. spent a lot of money to make sure that everybody knew that it was fraudulent elections. So they specifically were doing like monitoring and, you know, spend a lot of money on technical, like, to catch the fact that Shevardnadze was going to steal the elections. And then, of course, when he did, and it was like done in a very sloppy way, the student movement and Rustavi Ordi and the Saakashvili and his sort of band of reformers around him, their whole thing was to continue to tell people that these elections were stolen and agitate them. And this is what led to the Rose Revolution. They just told Chavez to leave. He pretty much did, because the U.S. also withdrew their support for him, which they said, like, fraudulent elections. So that helped to give more legitimacy that this government was illegitimate. Then the Rose Revolution happened, Saakashvili comes to power, and he is really right-wing. He establishes, like, we call primitive accumulation. He, like, accelerates it. First thing he does is strengthen the police force, and so the petty criminals, like I was saying, is a huge problem, are all put in jail. He builds, like, flashy sort of buildings, and he builds the roads, and to make it look like, sort of aesthetically, that things are changing, we're free. He made the police buildings, like, all glass to be, like, we're transparent.
And where'd the money come from?
U.S. was very supportive. Saakashvili has been their, like, golden child, at first, at least, as the person that established the rule of law.
Was this during the Clinton years?
This is 2003 until 2012. He brings in this guy called Bendukidze, who was, he's Georgian. He was Georgian. He passed away. But he was sort of an oligarch in Russia. He took advantage of, during the USSR, right when it broke down, it's supposed to have like voucher system to sell off property, and so a lot of people just got tons of capital for like $200, $10,000, like really cheap. And he was one of those people that, like, really profited from the chaos and the corruption. And he made a lot of money, and he was also really libertarian.
That's really a funny thing, because, you know, he gets rich off getting state property cheaply, and he's a big libertarian.
Yeah, he even says that. He's like, you know, I benefited from this, but I disagree with that. And he says something like, he's like, I'm going to, you know, we're going to reform Georgia. And he's like, it wouldn't work in Russia because Russian people are more collective, but Georgians are very individualistic, so it's going to work here. And so they have a huge, massive overhaul. There's a tax system that's like 22 different taxes, goes down to 6 different taxes. As I said, like, the police are sort of used to enforce everything, like financial police, which doesn't actually hide the fact that there was also secret funds and they were actually extorting businessmen. That was not on the books, but that's another story. And they open all borders, free trade, everything. Like, literally, this is the most, I mean, I don't know, maybe other countries may be more free trade. I just don't know any other country that has so many open borders, that has free trade deals with so many different countries. Also, we have the EU Association Agreement now, which is free trade with EU, where it signed a free trade agreement with China. And so we have almost no industry, just to let you know. We have almost nothing here. So free trade really means that we have, you know, a huge deficit. Like, we have, it's all imports here and barely any exports because we can't really produce that much. We don't have that much. And so in 2008, you probably remember the sort of the Russian aggression or Georgia-Russia war, however you want to frame it. That was like a sort of a big mistake. And after that, Saakashvili's approval rating sort of fell. And so when recognizing that his days were numbered after the failed war, Saakashvili made a move to sort of safeguard his legacy. They actually say this, Bendukidze, and like literally just a quote. The idea was to design a straitjacket for the irreversibility of reforms carried out by the government during the previous period and to create the basis for the inviolability of the principles of economic freedom. So they write something called the Liberty Act, which means they were going to put it in the Constitution. And by then, like, the president was very strong, and the parliament was more like an appendage. It wasn't as strong as it is now. So they write in the Constitution, the only constitution in the world that actually has addressed the taxes, which we have a flat tax system here, that you can never raise taxes unless the government initiates a referendum. And with addition to organic laws to the Constitution, it says that progressive taxation can never be on any referendum. And they call this, like, freedom. See, we're asking people if they want their tax raised. So they can only agree to raise taxes for everyone, as in a flat tax, so it goes up for everyone. And progressive taxation is completely off the table forever.
Everybody pays taxes starting from their first dollar. What's your currency?
Yes, lari.
Yeah, from their first lari of income, you're paying 20%.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Which is a lot. Like, it's so much, because it's so low, the salaries here. It literally, 20% could mean, like, you're eating or you're not eating. Most of the budget is filled by people who are working and, VAT tax, like the value-added tax, which is the sales tax. So it's mostly on the backs of the poor that the budget is filled. And the government now, which is supposedly more left, but which is not, got rid of the profit tax. There's no tax on profit now if they reinvest the profit. So by the Constitution, we can never raise the profit tax. Only the government can initiate a referendum. So to create a new tax or to raise taxes, I call this like checkmate, you know? It's like, no way can you actually have any progressive policies. So even if leftists, like, we were able to form, like, you know, amazing party and, like, got into government, we couldn't actually do anything because it's so constrained.
I'm speaking with Sofia Japaridze, a labor and feminist organizer in Georgia. According to standard libertarian thinking, you know, any think tank in Washington would tell you that you guys must be blossoming with prosperity now. Is that the way things are?
You know, I live right in front of the Russian embassy. And every morning, like, 200 people stand in front of the Russian embassy trying to get out. I look at this every morning, and I'm like, yeah, this is why everybody just votes with their feet, which means leaves. They just leave. Our biggest remittances are from Russia and Greece, but after actually the Greek financial crisis was actually devastation to Georgia, because a lot of Georgian women work there. So it used to be around 5 million people used to stay, and the census was done, I think, last year, and it's shown that we're only 3.7 million now.
Wow, that's quite an exodus.
Yeah. This is freedom, right? Like, we have a great country, right? It's like, it's prospering. I mean, so many jobs and so many well-paying jobs.
Now, is anybody getting rich off this?
maybe a lot of the oligarchs were already made during the 90s, you know, because that was when the big sort of overturn happened. The banks are actually the ones who are getting the richest. So it's like a financial capital dominates all other capital here. There's two huge banks that pretty much control everything. Businesses can't even borrow because the interest rates are so high. Banks get to decide who they give money to. Like at one point, they were investing heavily in construction. So they're building tons of buildings everywhere. And so they're like, you know, monopolies sort of capitalism. They get to decide which business gets to live and to die. And everybody has loans now, which, you know, again, nobody had these loans or credit cards. And they were sort of let loose on the population. And people borrowed and borrowed because I don't think they understood what that meant. Like, you're actually going to lose your house. You know, if you put your house on mortgage, like, you were going to lose it. Most people have tons of loans to curb petty criminals and to give a sense of, like, we're actually, like, now a civilized country, quote-unquote, like, you know, European, was to give, like, sort of unsecured and also freely accessible credit. There's a lot of micro loans here and like online loans where you can get a loan in 10 minutes.
But try to pay it back.
Yeah, exactly.
Some of the other former Soviet republics, you know, I think Uzbekistan and such, turn into really horrible despotic regimes, cults of personality, dissidents boiled alive, that sort of thing. Georgia escaped that fate and ended up as a libertarian paradise. Why did Georgia take this unusual route?
It goes back to, I think, in some way, our history. One is that we are individualistic nation. It's very petty bourgeois country. Mentality, consciousness, very petty bourgeois. And we're closer to Europe, and we've always had this self-identification as more European and, like, anti-Asiatic, you know, sort of white supremacist in a lot of ways, too. So I would say from the beginning, if you look at USSR, who was benefiting the most in the republics, Georgia was either the first or the second.
And was that subsidies coming from Moscow?
The subsidies and every kind of support. I mean, also, like, we were able to have higher education, getting to more, like, higher up positions. So it's like we didn't really deserve a lot of things, but we got a lot of things. And also, culturally, our Georgian films were very popular, you know, and, like, Georgian, like, singers and so on. So, like Georgia was always a lot more like the golden child than the Stans, who were sort of neglected, always.
Before I press the record button, we were talking about right-wing feminism in Georgia. Could you talk about that and if there's any kind of left-wing feminism to respond to it?
Yeah, so like what I was saying, Saakashvili, the Rose Revolution, and there was a lot of NGOs before and after that developed. And so a lot of NGOs were also around, you know, donors. I don't know if you know, but all they do is they want to give money to sort of like women's equality and women this and women that. So clearly there would be tons of NGOs that have the subject theme or whatever as some kind of women empowerment. The big names here, the big feminist names, which mostly focus on more women in parliament is one. Like a lot of the feminist sort of movement, they're not socialists. And they're mostly have connections to the United Nations Movement Party, which is Saakashvili, the Rose Revolution that was ousted. And just to give you an example, one of those leaders of the feminist movement called, when we were discussing the constitutional, like we want to remove it, constitutional amendments, she called progressive taxation making rich people poor. And we criticized, just giving, there was a company that defrauded tons of immigrant women in Greece. The head of the gender committee at one point was one of the partners in this business that defrauded all these women. So we had posted something like, you know, like liberal feminism has to think about the fact that their biggest supporters are people who are actually preying on poor women. We had posted that, and we were attacked, saying that we were anti-feminists. That, like, they deliberately did not want to understand what we were saying. Rich people, especially head of gender committee, right, was involved in defrauding a lot of poor women, immigrant women. So we were, by the feminist movement heads, leaders, we have been decried as anti-feminists just because we talked about that. Almost all the discourse that they want to talk about is not that there's so much labor done by women here, the fact that everyday life for women is a lot harder, and the fact that most immigrants are women who are supporting their families, who haven't seen their families in years and years, maybe decades. Children grew up without, you know, they've remittances from women, a lot of women, especially in Greece and Italy, have kept this country alive. And so we focus on that aspect, right? and not like sexual freedom, which is what they want to focus on, or just women, more women in parliament. It doesn't matter which, who, what kind of woman, just any woman. And the women there in parliament are the ones who are for big corporations.
That's kind of feminism you described, you know, sort of reminds me of, in some ways, of, you know, the bourgeois feminism in the West, upper class, rich ladies feminism, but without a real deep constituency. Here we have this professional managerial class to whom Sheryl Sandberg speaks, but to whom does this speak in Georgia?
No one. That's the strange part. They have no connection to the masses. The nonprofits, the lots of donors, the money, come in, and they have created an artificial sort of class, if you want to say, or subclass, that's kept alive by high salaries from foreign donors. Those people do everything for the sake of donors. So when, you know, Americans or Europeans, they look at their activity, they're like, this is great. You're doing a great job. And so they have actually no desire or need, necessity, to actually go to the people, actually try to find the regular women, you know, actually somehow, like, build a base around them. They don't need to, because they're still going to get the money.
So what kind of resistance to all this is there?
Not a lot. Mostly people, regular people, sort of have just a hatred of feminism. They hate feminists. I mean, seriously, they have severe hatred.
What, is it a deeply patriarchal culture?
Yes, of course, yeah. Also, and the Orthodox Church is very strong. That makes everything much more difficult. And so what's happening is that while introducing this form of feminism that speaks to no one's needs besides elites, what it does is reinforce a more Orthodox Christian sort of value system.
This combination of patriarchy, libertarianism, and that kind of conservative religion sounds very much like an American right-winger's fantasy come to earth.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they get to treat Georgia as their little laboratory?
Absolutely, yes. These libertarians, since they've come in since 2003, really, and like sort of taken power, they've built universities here and institutes. And so almost all economists are all libertarian. And they're considered like really great schools or great institutes or great parts, you know, like of universities, like the main university, there's like a little sub-institute where they train economists, you know, master's degrees and stuff. It's all funded by not only American, but European right-wing groups, right-wing think tanks, like Atlas Network, Cato Institute.
And what about repression? Does the government give people like you a lot of trouble, or are you allowed to do what you want to because you're really not all that powerful?
The government here has a really interesting politics. They're really not repressive. They're repressive towards drugs, though, I'll say that. We have the opposite problem. There was like a protest recently in our seaside sort of city, and it was actually the right wing who were protesting and burned cars. And the government did almost nothing. What I've noticed, and it was actually student protest, they took over a building forever, for like months and months. They took over a building. They never bothered. I'm just like if this happened in the U.S., like we'd all be in jail like forever. Like here, it's the government has played more hands-off policy because they don't want to be seen as repressive. But I think they're actually more effective this way, because if you don't give people any attention, they just sort of diffuse themselves.
And as you said, there's very little resistance to this agenda, except for rioting right-wingers for whom it's not right-wing enough.
Yeah. People who are questioning any kind of free market ideology at all, I'm just giving an example. There's a new party here, this Libertarian Party, and they wrote a hit piece on us, said that we were Russian agents who were trying to destroy and were enemies of Georgia, and said that socialism was the weapon of Russia, like an imperialist tool to dominate, colonize Georgia. And we were Russian agents.
That's the all-purpose charge these days.
In the parliament, nobody knows anything besides sort of free market. Like, it's amazing to me. If you have any critique of FDI, like, and just free borders or any kind of comment about economics, it's not about no taxation or what's good for business or, you know, like how to make it easier for business. I mean, you can start a company here in one day. It's super easy. Like, they made everything for business. And also, like, we protect workers, like a kind of like a trade union. And you should just see the things that these capitalists do to the workers. I mean, it's amazing to me, like the level of exploitation and oppression here. And there's almost no recourse, and consciousness isn't there among the people. because they have internalized a lot of the free market ideology, even they'll say, well, if I don't like it, I should just leave.
Well, it sounds like a quarter of the population has done that.
Yeah, exactly. Left, yeah, exactly. I mean, you should see the fact that I'm like, you know, like I've lived in America. Everyone's like, why did you come back? I get this question asked like every day. Why did you come back to this hellhole? Why would you leave such an amazing country and come here?
And what's your answer?
I try to explain to them it's not that amazing, but they don't believe me. They just think I'm like a hater. Like I'm just making stuff up. They're like, how could you say that? It's so prosperous, and everyone makes it there. And I know a friend of mine or my relative who now is rich there. Everyone can make it if they just work hard.
That was Sophia Japaridze, a labor and feminist organizer in Georgia. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. It's been a chilly, rainy, most unspring-like week in New York, and now it looks to be yielding to some more delightfully seasonally appropriate weather. So let's go at this. Some of The Sun Comes Out, the Mutant Disco Mix by Fats and Small from 2004. Till next week, bye.
Morning dew in cold November rain. Ocean waves, those careless days will never be the same. 'Cause you and I will always try to keep our secret blue. Me and you, we always knew that the sun comes.